First, while the Nobel Prize has been awarded since 1901, 2018 marked the only the third time a woman won the Nobel Prize in physics. In fact, two women brought home science Nobels this year in physics and in chemistry. But female Nobel laureates in the sciences are few and far between. Our next guest says that raises questions about women's careers and recognition in the science field. Let's take a listen to Donna Strickland, 2018's Nobel laureate in physics, talking with NPR on All Things Considered about being the third woman in history to win the prize in physics.
It hadn't occurred to me. I hadn't looked at all the Nobel Prizes and thought, my goodness, there's no women. So it was a little bit surprising to me. But I mean, I do live in a world of mostly men, so seeing mostly men doesn't really ever surprise me either. So, yes, there you go. I feel unbelievably honored to be, you know, with Marie Curie and David Meyer. It's like, how can I be in the same breath as those three?
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a woman working in science or planning to pursue science in your future? Do you see barriers holding you back? Do you get treated equally to male counterparts? And do you think younger women are getting enough exposure to the STEM fields early on? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mary Feeney is an associate professor and Lincoln Professor of Ethics and Public Affairs and associate director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy Studies at Arizona State University. She wrote the piece headlined "Why More Women Don't Win Science Nobels" for The Conversation. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, in that piece, you share a lot of research out there on women in all stages of the science, technology, engineering, and math fields. How big a deal is it to see these Nobel Prizes for women in the sciences this year?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It's a sign of the times, right? Women have been increasing in their numbers in STEM fields, and so we would expect to see more women getting these kinds of awards in the future simply because there's more women in the workforce, more women doing this kind of work. But I still think there are real substantial barriers that women face in STEM fields.
We'll spend most of our time talking about those barriers, but you see some bright spots kind of early on, women, girls, being exposed more to science fields and considering them as future options. What are we seeing?
Well, I think we've seen some really focused efforts at addressing this sort of gender disparity in STEM fields. A lot has been coming through sort of education policy, higher education policy. There, I think, you know, in the 80s and 70s, there was a real recognition that women were not pursuing these majors at the same rates that they were in the humanities and the liberal arts. And so a lot of organizations like the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Physical Society, chemistry societies, but also universities, the National Science Foundation, started to really develop targeted programs that would address some of these gender disparities, whether that was getting young girls more interested in science, things like Girls Can Code and science camps for girls only, and then also sort of focusing on how to create support networks for women moving through that pipeline. And so we've seen real improvements in the educational pipeline of women in STEM fields. Women are at parity in the medical sciences, the sort of biology medical sciences, but they still are a bit underrepresented in fields like chemistry and physics.
And are there fields where they're particularly underrepresented?
Yeah, there's been some recent studies that have actually found that as the sciences were seeing an increase of women in STEM fields, there's been a real drop-off in computer science. And so there's a lot of concern about sort of what's going on, why are women not sort of increasing in number, given that, you know, women are making up a large proportion of college students now, why aren't they choosing these degrees?
How important is it for girls and young women to see role models, women in the science fields who have been successful over the decades?
So there's some mixed findings on the sort of research related to role models. So I think we all kind of have an intuitive understanding of why role models matter, right? When we see people that look like us or appear like us in high-level positions, we can imagine ourselves in those positions. So there's a lot of that sort of role modeling that's important to people in, I think, a bit more of how we perceive ourselves and how we perceive opportunities. But then the role modeling that's kind of most important, especially in education systems and higher education, is seeing female role models in the classroom, right? Seeing people that look like you teaching the courses you're taking, seeing professors in that field. And so there's there's this sort of role modeling from the sense of like award winners or superstars or people we see on TV, and then the role modeling that's really happening in the classroom.
So for women who decide to pursue sciences, say in the college field, what kind of obstacles do they start to hit that may turn them away from it or may prevent them from having a successful career?
Well, I think historically, especially in STEM fields, there were real obstacles that were related to the sort of structure of the job, the way the science is done. You might need to be in the lab every day for really long hours. You might have to be on site. You might have to go out into the field and collect data or collect samples. And so there were sort of barriers to having work-life balance, or if you had a child, you would have to leave the lab for an extended period of time, and then you couldn't come back and sort of get your research back on track. I think institutions have really tried to figure out ways around some of this, ways that they can alter the structure of the science itself or the way that the job is, the way that the job and promotions are designed. And then there's this sort of other issue of harassment in the workplace, which, you know, we've seen a lot in the news lately. And things like Title IX, sort of formal policies that have said you can't have gender discrimination in the workplace, in the classroom, these have obviously had really sort of important effects on keeping women in these fields.
Talking to Mary Feeney from Arizona State University, looking at obstacles still out there for women going into science fields. Here's one stat from the piece we're talking about. You wrote, men cite their papers 56% more, their own papers, I should say. Men cite their own papers 56% more than women do. So what's behind that? What kind of impact could that have?
Yeah, so this is something that's pretty particular to the academic workforce. Citations are how much your research is being recognized by other people. And so what some of this research has found is that men are better able or feel more empowered to promote their own work, to cite their own work, and then they might also have networks that are citing their work more thoroughly. And so it helps to raise their reputation, the perception of the reputation, the perception of the value of their work. There was a recent paper that just came out in a political science journal that showed the ways in which Google Scholar citations are biased against women, younger scholars, and scholars doing really risky work. And while these biases are subtle, they can have real long-term effects if your promotion, your tenure, your ability to get an award or be invited to give a guest talk is determined by this reputational effect. And so these citation things are very particular to academic work, but it's really important for scientists because that's a lot of how the scientific community assesses the value and impact of your research.
And then letters of recommendation. These are a big deal in the academic world. Did I read this right? Women who receive letters of recommendation, say from the professor here to get a job over there, there's more likely to be some kind of like disclaimer or negative statement or qualifying statement in those?
Yeah, like language that sort of pulls back on the praise of the candidate, where you might see language that's like, he is very smart, he's really ambitious. And then with the woman, it will say, well, she's very ambitious, which can get in the way of her getting along with others in the workplace or something, right? So the compliment will be pulled back with some sort of negative comment. And while this seems, well, we can think of individual situations where this does or doesn't happen, these studies are looking at, you know, applications across large cross-sections of academic scientists and finding these patterns. And we see this in job applications, but also in applications for students to get into graduate school, that the language that's used to describe female candidates might refer to their parenting abilities or their ability to get along and to be socially acceptable, where the references to the male performance will be about sort of work performance.
I want to spend our last few minutes on some of the solutions you propose. What are a couple things that you see maybe making a big difference in the short run?
So I think one of the things that's been really great about this implicit bias issue is there's a lot of social science research looking at how this implicit bias works, how common it is, and what the long-term effects are of the implicit bias. And so there's just been a slew of research in the last 5 years that's come out to really show the way in which these bias are creating barriers to women, but barriers that aren't as apparent to us as not having family leave or not being able to take your children to work might be a more obvious barrier that women face. And so I think the research is coming out, people are talking about it more, and in response to these findings, people are organizing and being more cognizant of how they make decisions about who gets awards, who's nominated for things, how they engage in citation. So one of the responses to this gender bias in citation is one scholar built a website where you can go and check your citations to see that they're gender balanced. You can run the syllabi you're developing for a course you're teaching to ensure that there's equal representation of people's work. So I think people are developing tools to help address some of these problems.
Now, a layperson, somebody not in the sciences, might think, well, you know, as long as somebody's doing the science, it doesn't really matter who it is. But are we maybe missing out on potential breakthroughs if a big part of the population isn't being given a shot to break into the industry?
Yeah, I think that's one of the underlying reasons why science funders like the federal government and why professional associations are really engaged in tackling some of these gender disparity issues in the workplace, because diverse groups of people bring more ideas and more creativity to a team. And as we've seen in these STEM fields, collaborative science, team science, big groups of scientists working together to solve problems are becoming much more common. And so when we have 5, 6, 7 scientists working on something together, it's just better for the science to have people who come from different perspectives, different backgrounds, and who think about problems in different ways. They're more likely to come up with creative solutions.
It's a good place to leave it. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Feeney is an associate professor and Lincoln Professor of Ethics and Public Affairs and the associate director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy Studies at Arizona State University. She wrote the piece, Why More Women Don't Win Science Nobels, for The Conversation.